Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have as my guest Clifford Chase. He has written a first novel called Winky, published by Grove Press. He's the author as well of The Hurry Up Song, a memoir of losing my brother, and Queer 13, of which he was the editor. It was Lesbian and Gay Writers Recall 7th Grade. Now, Winky is, to put it mildly, a very strange book, and the least strange thing about it is its plot. In it, a teddy bear comes to life and becomes eventually accused within a year of having life bestowed upon him or having attained life. He becomes accused of terrorism. I would say that that is just the beginning of the strangeness of the book, but maybe you could tell more about how odd it is to talk about this book to people and the looks you must get when describing it.
Yeah, it was especially weird when I was working on it, and also I worked on it for 10 years, so it was especially weird to say that I had been working, you know, 9 years on a book about my teddy bear. I think part of the oddness is taking a teddy bear as the main character of an adult literary novel. It's not a children's book. There are some not exactly adult situations, but some, you know, it's about, there's a terrorist trial and there's political satire, and he's kind of almost like an anti-hero in that sense. He's a kind of very silly little thing to make. Try to make the hero of a book, and to try to make him, I mean, at least for me, he began to really live as a character in a way that I never would have thought possible when I began the writing about him just as a short story. I would never dream that I could have sustained that for an entire novel. And I don't know, I suppose to me that's kind of the core of the oddness, just that, and which is kind of, you know, that people seem to respond to him and the way they would to any character in a novel. And I guess that kind of gets at sort of some of the original impulses of the book too, just the way that trying to go back to childhood and the way that I played and the way that I told stories and the way that children relate to their toys and the way that they empathize and the way that they learn empathy at a very early age. And then just the roots of empathy and the roots of storytelling and the fact that, you know, to a child, you know, you put a sock on your hand and it's a person, you know, immediately. And that in a way that's theater, you know, that moment that we believe and we are, you know, it's the suspension of disbelief. And this book is kind of an extended exercise in suspending disbelief.
Yeah, if I were asked what's strange about this book, I would say that its strangeness and its beauty is that we don't know what to make of the precious things of our childhood. We don't even know where to put them. You know, where do you put that record collection now that you don't have a turntable anymore and you're afraid to throw them out? The covers are so beautiful, and the toys and the spectrograph or Etch-a-Sketch or whatever you had. These things formed you, and yet you no longer know what they are. And so in this book, Winky goes from being a girl's teddy bear to a boy's teddy bear as it gets inherited, and in the process he/she changes sex. And, you know, brings to mind Virginia Woolf's Orlando, but also the rage of that the culture is making now about how to define gender. And how do you define gender when it's not your gender, but the gender of something you loved that had no gender. You know, what was projected upon it. And then the politics of the excluded creature. Winky is described, really, whoever has owned her or him, he is not a particularly sympathetic teddy bear. He likes it when things are going wrong. He likes the sawdust in the oil, in a certain sense. He likes things when things are falling or broken. He likes intransigence. He's having been silent for so many years. He chooses to remain silent during his trial, like Bartleby. This is. So I thought that what was fun was the indefinability, you know, and I felt like the writing was going along, discovering not the character, but the indefinability of the character.
I spent many, many pages of my journal trying to understand what Winky was. And, you know, one of the ways I put it to myself was I thought, okay, he's a blurry metaphor. He doesn't have to, he doesn't have to apply to any single thing. He has all these kind of different meanings and they kind of shift. And then later I was reading, just kind of as part of my research and in my, not exactly despair, but just in my just incomprehension of my own book, I read the Freud's interpretation of dreams, which was just beautiful, by the way, and kind of began to understand that Winky, in a way, is like a dream metaphor. He's overdetermined, would be the, I guess, the technical term, that there are lots of meanings attached to him, and
they fit together and don't fit together at the same time. They're like pieces of a puzzle that should belong together, but you can't find the edge.
Yeah, and that kind of works together, you know, that there's this kind of, the book is kind of a patchwork of memoir and or autobiographical material and fable, where he runs away to the forest and has this kind of Edenic existence, and then the political satire, and that's kind of a patchwork that's kind of, or a puzzle that's kind of fitted together, and then he, you know, he himself is kind of, you know, mended, and his seams show. You can actually, in the photographs in the book, you can actually see his seams, and he really was my teddy bear, and he really was my mother's teddy bear, and I took photographs of him for the book.
And x-rays.
And I had him x-rayed, yes. I got the courage up to do that, and yes, at an x-ray place in Brooklyn in my neighborhood. It was $15. They were quite amused. I think they were afraid I was some kind of drug dealer or something, or that there was some kind of, you know, I imagine like a Maltese Falcon kind of thing or something.
And you should have said, no, no, he's an empty signifier.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Now, you had been something of a virtuoso of this subject. The book, The Hurry Up Song, begins with stories about the puppets that you called Muppets, although they weren't actual Muppets, I think. And in your contribution to Queer 13, the dress-up of dolls and playing things, so that, and this became your marker as a gay child. The place where people were either, I would guess, charmed or stigmatized?
Yeah, definitely.
So it's almost as if the question then shifts to what does it do to the bear itself to be loved in this way that involves abandonment, that necessitates abandonment. And Winky is someone who remembers being left behind as the family evacuates during a hurricane.
Actually, could you elaborate that a little bit with relating it to the gay child?
Well, you know, first the gay child is marked by his preference for dolls and teddy bears, but then perhaps the teddy bear is marked by being abandoned by one child after another. Uh-huh. What is that? You know, and don't we all feel that too as we live a life of abandonment? But what is our first abandoned object?
Uh-huh.
How does it feel?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
We got it ready for our own experiences in some peculiar way.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, and, you know, I guess I kind of thought of him as, it was just a way to kind of look at repression in a way, and the way that, you know, what you said earlier about, you know, our childhoods are kind of lost to us in a way. And I kind of reversed the polarity of that and looked at it from the point of view of the toy who's lost, who's left behind by the children. And in terms of the loss, I mean, this is sort of a slight tangent, but it's interesting because, you know, a friend of mine who's a mother had this interesting reaction to the book because she said that, you know, when you're a parent, you keep losing your children over and over because, well, particularly when they become teenagers, you lose your children. And that she saw that, she kind of felt that also in Winky's getting left behind and the way that – and I think, you know, as kids when we're growing up, we do leave ourselves behind. And I felt like I could dramatize that by seeing what's left behind in Winky and that he's a repository for all of it.
Well, in my case, for instance, I had my – stuffed animal collection forcibly removed from me
uh-huh.
in childhood. It was discovered that I had allergies to dust and dirt.
Uh-huh.
And my parents, bewildered, were told, oh, well, what do we do? You know, and the doctor said, well, no plush carpeting, no great loss.
Uh-huh.
No stuffed animals that uh-huh. attract dust and lint. And so they were thrown into the exterminator.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yes, and I wasn't warned.
Wow.
And so I lived through the extermination of a whole community of animals that I'd given voices to, that had personalities to me.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was regarded as being too precious, too cute, too adorable for me to protract my mourning
uh-huh.
for them.
Uh-huh.
And yet it was real.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. How old were you when that happened?
Oh, it must have been 6 or 7.
Oh, yeah. Well, that would be the age to...
Yeah, uh-huh. Terrible anxiety. So uh-huh. I had a great deal... I was envious that the teddy bear survived
uh-huh.
and it ends up, you know, in Cairo.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, my mother was in a lot of ways very wonderful about that kind of thing. You know, she had, you know, the teddy bear had been hers. So, of course, you know, she wasn't going to throw it away after I was done with him. And she hung on to him for, you know, many years. And then I started writing about him. And then I started photographing him, you know, at first at my parents' house. And then she let me take Winky back to New York with me at some point so that I could continue photographing him. And
interviewing him.
And interviewing him,
and interrogating him.
Yeah, yeah. So, but that kind of, my mother was very, was really great about that kind of playfulness, you know, and even as, you know, as an adult writing about Winky, she didn't find that to be strange at all. She didn't think I had taken a nosedive into some kind of further insanity than I was already in.
This is Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Clifford Chase, author most recently of Winky, published by Grove Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Clifford Chase about his novel, Winky. Now, one of the things I noticed is that the first half of the book is Winky's memories of things that happen, before the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so the figure of the pariah, the unintegratable figure, is the black people in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in a 5 and 10, in New Orleans, a store manager announces no coloreds and then looks at Winky and says, present company accepted.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
Winky understands himself as a colored.
Uh-huh.
But in the second part, the figure of the rejected becomes very complex because it seemed to be a figure of a terrorist. And it's as if between the two sections of the novel, we watch the figure of the excluded becoming a very complex and potentially threatening figure, from a dream figure to a nightmare figure in the course of time.
There's one aspect of that is that, one aspect is that, you know, my mother got Winky, she called him Marie, and she got him in 1925 in Chicago. The chapter about my childhood takes place in New Orleans in the early 60s at a time of when the schools were just being desegregated, actually. And right around a time of a major hurricane, too, just with a weird coincidence with Katrina. But I did feel that I was thinking about Winky as an outsider, and I was looking for those themes to look at in my mother's childhood and my childhood. And, you know, certainly racism was a big part of my childhood, quite honestly. And it's just part of my family history. And I hadn't – and then as far as – you know, Chicago goes, that's also a big part of that city's history, sadly. And when I visited Chicago to go see my mother's old neighborhood to take a picture of her house to use in the book, I was told by an older white man not to go to to the other side of the tracks, just completely unsolicited advice. And it was really instructive about, you know, a whole legacy of that. And I suppose I was trying – that was part of the kind of legacy of family that I was trying to write about, and a legacy of exclusion, really. And then the more modern story, which, you know, is a post-9/11 story that happens in the book, is, you know, the exclusion that's happening is largely, you know, one of, you know, immigrants and Muslims is kind of – the latest fashion of exclusion, and was kind of just, you know, it was in just so present in the news that I decided to go ahead and bring that into the novel, although oddly enough terrorism was already in the novel before 9/11 happened. But then – and I actually thought I might have to take it out of the novel when 9/11 happened, because I didn't see how I could really deal with with mm-hmm. that in a mm-hmm. comic novel, in the setting of a comic novel, an essentially comic novel, although it's a very sad novel too, but
melancholic,
yeah. And but then, you know, then I started, you know, as the response to 9/11 kind of became clear and grew and morphed into pretty quickly into torture and rounding up innocent people as well as guilty people and holding them without charges and that sort of thing, I began to feel that the idea that was already there, which was Winky would be unjustly accused of a series of bombings, that could be carried forward into a post-9/11 world. So in a way, part of the disjuncture you're seeing is it really is a it's what the novel was in the first 5 years I was writing it versus the second 5 years I was writing it.
And oh, that's very interesting, because I think in that period as well, something happened to the nature of unalloyed affection.
Huh.
And so in part two of the novel, the beloved figure of the teddy bear is being fused and conflated with the feared figure of the terrorist. And it creates this kind of really unstable, this kind of shuddering image. And you say constantly, how can they be interrogating this teddy bear, as do the good people in the novel? How can they be in? Can't they see it's a teddy bear? And experts are called in, almost as if to say, look at what you've turned into the boogeyman.
Uh-huh.
Look at how many false boogeymen we've constructed.
Right, right. And I think it kind of the childhood themes kind of dovetailed in another way too, which is that I do think we are being treated as scared children by our government. And those are very primal emotions too. They go back to childhood.
Now, there's another strain of the novel which is very interesting to me as well, and why I say that the peculiarity of the book is in its variety, and that is the spiritual strain. At the very beginning, the family have at one time been Christian Scientists, and this is an interrogation on the liveliness, the animateness of inert matter.
Uh-huh.
And so
right.
Winky thinks about his own soul as being made of threads.
Uh-huh.
But the process of the book, on trial, Winky has his spiritual essences returned to him by a series of witnesses, one of whom, a bear collector, says that he's a rare bear. The other, an anthropologist who specializes in animism, talks about how he represents the centers of the possibility of faith. Now, this is comic as it occurs in the novel, but as soon as you think that most of the writers who've written about toys, famously, Rilke wrote an essay on dolls, and Baudelaire did too, and they find them spiritual objects. You know, for Rilke, of course, it's not that a doll dies. That's not what we mourn about. It's that the doll won't come to life.
Uh-huh.
So it teaches us about the refusal of life.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. But I sensed in the book that this spirit is, in a sense, the thing that's the greatest danger to the book. The book is trying to resist the idea of taking Winky too seriously, because that real seriousness will provoke the greatest laughter.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, it kind of I kind of walked some kind of line there where I suppose it's like I guess it's agnosticism, really. You know, I didn't want to come down on the side of, you know, non-spirituality, but I didn't want to come on down on the side of spirituality either. I guess I didn't want to be cynical about spirituality. I just wanted, and I guess, at least metaphorically speaking, Winky really is, really does have a soul to me. Actually, there's a John Updike essay about Mickey Mouse where he says Mickey Mouse has soul. And I definitely felt that way about Winky, that there's, you know, he just lived for me. And in some ways, I thought, well, you know, agnostically speaking, treating him seriously as a soul, as a spiritual being, if nothing else, that has metaphorical truth for me really the same way, as a fictional character, he has being for me.
I'm curious, now that he's been both a muse and a subject, what is he to you? How has he been altered by the process of your writing about him?
Well, it's very strange. I mean, sometimes, you know, I'll take him out and look at him, and I kind of can't believe what he looks like. I mean, partly because, you know, there are pictures of him in the book, but when you see him in person, and it's kind of shocking because he's so weird looking and he's very tiny. He's only about a foot tall, and that in itself is such a kind of a testament to a whole other era when before supersizing, basically, you know, when toys were the proper size for children, you know, and just it's so 1924 to be that tiny. And then also, you know, he lives so much on the page to me that then I kind of forget that he's actually he exists as an object in the world. And then I look at him and then, you know, I feel a little bit like I'm very close to, you know, that I just, if I go just a little more crazy than I am, I'll start talking to him, you know, and if guests come over, I'll make them say hello to him, you know, you know, it just, because he is kind of so real to me as a fictional character, I've never had that experience before. And, I up until this time, I've worked mainly in a very autobiographical vein. And there is that in the book, obviously. But, you know, then he just kind of became this being. And in a way, I don't know how else to describe him except a being. And I suppose sort of the mystery of, you know, what is fiction and why does it work? You mm-hmm. know, why does it move us? Why can we relate to it and go along with it, you know? And why can we watch a puppet show and care about, you know, that puppet? Or, you know, I was just talking last night to friends about the Todd Haynes' first movie, Superstar, where he has a Barbie doll play Karen Carpenter. And within 30 seconds of that movie, that doll, which only moves a tiny bit, you know, that doll is Karen Carpenter, and you care about that character. It's a very moving movie. And why is that? It's a very strange, I mean, it has a lot to do with just our capacity for empathy, you mm-hmm. know, really, which I think in this day and age is a really important capacity.
I've been speaking with Clifford Chase, author of Winky, published by Grove Press. Thank you, Clifford, for joining me.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be here.
You can read an excerpt from Winky on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica, and you can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, from our website. Go to kcrw.com and look for Bookworm under KCRW A to Z. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.